Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one, Lynn Webb. Lynn is a dog trainer and canine massage therapist who lives in Escondido, California in North San Diego County. She is certified as a dog trainer through the Karen Pryor Academy and as a massage therapist through the Rocky Mountain School of Animal Acupressure and Massage. Lynn has a master's degree in the United States history and worked for 15 years at the San Diego Wild Animal Park, now known as San Diego Zoo Safari Park, in various positions including tour guide, educator, and zookeeper. Today, as a dog trainer with her own company, The Proficient Pup, Lynn specializes in assisting clients with their anxious, shy, or aggressive dogs. She has a strong interest in alleviating the fears that pet dogs experience in varying environments, including rattlesnake habitat. When educating people about rattlesnake avoidance, she wants to show them that there is a way to teach a dog to avoid something without teaching them to fear it. Lynn also believes that we humans can respect wildlife and protect our dogs at the same time. Because when it comes to snake avoidance training, it's not about the snake, it's about the choices we make. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one, Lynn Webb, to the show today, who's patiently waiting by. Lynn, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to do this.
Me too, and I wish that people listening could see that massive smile on your face.
I have a big smile.
It's making me smile as well. We're really excited to have you here, Lynn, and I'm really excited to discuss the things we're going to discuss today and the frame of thinking about things that surrounds this discussion that we're going to have. So let's dive straight into the first question, Lynn, and this is all about you. Can you please take everyone listening back to where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training and share some stories from some of the first animals you ever trained using it?
Absolutely. So I would say the first time I really was using positive reinforcement or working around it and being aware also that that's what it was when I was working at the Safari Park. And I may just call it Safari Park or Park from now on. So I was working there as a tour guide. So I had already had some other jobs before that there. Like I started as a ticket seller and I did some other things. So, but when I was a tour guide, they have, well, I'll explain a little bit of what the zoo looks like or that park. So they've got very wide open exhibits. They have some smaller exhibits with some smaller animals, but where you're going to find like the rhinoceros and the giraffes and tons of different kinds of gazelle and other kinds of antelope, and they have deer, they're all in one exhibit and they're very large. So they have several very large exhibits of, you know, could be 80 acres, 60 acres. And they would have trucks, the actual open trucks, in where a guest could go into those exhibits. So you're closer to those animals, and then the trucks drive up close and you can have closer interactions than you would being farther back in a maybe a more typical zoo environment. So at any rate, I was the guide on the back of that truck, and we would have 10 or so people on the back with me. And then we could go up to various animals. And one of the interactions that we had is a giraffe feeding. So we'd drive out into a particular area where the giraffes liked to hang out. There are lots of hills in the exhibit, so we pick a nice spot that's flat and easier for the giraffes and for the truck. And then and we would feed the giraffes from the back of the truck. So the keepers separately were doing some training so that we would be able to do this. So they were actually the ones training. We as tour guides were not doing the training, but we benefited from it. And so we understood, and that's when I understood what that positive reinforcement was and what it was doing. So the presence of the truck itself became kind of a cue for the giraffes to come up, because they could expect us to be feeding them biscuits or leaves. And what was fun about it is that the giraffes could go anywhere in the exhibit to get that food. They had tons of food was set out for them by the keepers, all sorts of hay and alfalfa and acacia leaves and things like that. But they would choose, they could choose and would choose to come up to the truck. So whether they preferred to be hand fed, I don't really know, but they liked it. So they would approach us. And so that right there is already, they would repeatedly do it. So we knew, right, that that was positively reinforcing for them. So they would approach. Now, we were off the ground several feet, maybe, you know, 6, 7, 8 feet off the ground. But of course, the giraffes are twice that. So they were still looming over us, which was part of the experience and fun. As you know, or other, you know, zookeepers or people who work around giraffes that might be listening, they're big animals. And, you know, although people think of them as gentle giants, they're very strong and, you know, they can get cranky too. And so it's not fun to be next to a cranky giraffe or even one that's going to be pushy. So what happened was that they would come down to get the food and everything. That was great. My job was really to keep the people on the truck safe. So I had to make sure we had some distance from those giraffes. The guests were not allowed to touch them or pet them, just feed them only. So they come down, we safely feed them, they bring their head back up, usually kind of look around a little bit, what's going on around me, and then they come back down to eat. That was a great scenario. That's what we wanted. So what inevitably would happen is that these giraffes, some of them, sometimes it would be in the adolescents, typically adolescent males, would get a little pushier. And so they would, you know, if they bring their chests to the edge of the truck, their neck can go in significantly. They can bring it down into the back of this truck, significantly getting into our space. And again, me not feeling safe. Everybody loved it, but the tour guide in me in the back of the truck wasn't loving it, because I couldn't keep my guests as safe as I wanted to with this big, huge, heavy, you know, head that's swinging around, that's all bone, with two little nice little bone protrusions on the top that are perfect for, you know, knocking you down. So at any rate, the keepers came up with a great plan for us. Again, not us being trainers, but if we wanted to be able to get our safety space back, we needed to be able to get the giraffes back from us. So now I know it's a lure, but at the time I really didn't think about that. But what we would actually do is when we want the giraffe to back up, we would hold the biscuit or leaf towards their chest without touching them. Just hold it towards their chest because of the angle and the way, of course, they're not physically capable of reaching down to their chest like that to get that leaf. They would have to back up. They would have to back up a few spaces. Then they could come down and were positively reinforced for backing up. So we kind of gave it a lure of kind of putting it in their space where they needed to back up, and then they could get that food. So some of the more clever among those giraffes, of course, they chain that behavior, right, pretty quickly. Oh, you're not feeding me fast enough, or oh, you're taking time to stop to talk to your guests and I still want food. So guess what? I'm going to push into your space. You're going to back me up. I'm going to eat. I'm going to push into your space. You're going to back me up and going to eat. So there were limitations on what we could do because of, you know, the keepers were doing that training. So sometimes we would just have to drive away, and that was the option. Like, oh, this giraffe is really just kind of messing with us and we have to drive away. We'll find another one, or whatever we needed to do. But it gave me some insight then to kind of see how chains work and how it's pretty quick. And it has nothing to do with really an animal being a jerk. It just has to do with what works for them. And so the understanding there for that giraffe was I can get fed faster if they back me up, and then I get fed that way too. If I just sit here calmly and kind of wait for them, you know, that rate of reinforcement isn't moving as quickly. So that's, I think, my first real kind of realizing what positive reinforcement actually was and how it worked. And so what was interesting about that is we would also feed the rhinoceros too in that same truck. So we'd drive into another exhibit and feed the Asian rhinos or the Indian rhinos. And because those were lower to us, they would come out over to the truck as well and be fed. But we didn't really have to, ironically, because people thought, oh, rhinoceros, that's so much more dangerous than feeding a giraffe. And I was like, no, it's way easier because they're lower than we are. We don't have to worry about a big swinging head. But at any rate, that's also where I could learn about positive reinforcement and the value of reinforcement, because they would oftentimes not come over to the truck. And it depended, because if they were in a nice, big, you know, gross mud hole with lots of water and mud in it, and it was a 90 degree day and they're soaking in that mud, they don't really care about the apples that we were feeding them. Apples are great, but it takes them a while to get out of the mud. They got to walk up to get to the truck. It could be several minutes. And for them, it was much nicer, obviously, for them to stay in that mud hole, because they oftentimes would. So that was also a nice look at how reinforcement works, and not just the rate of reinforcement, which the giraffes were focusing on, but also the value of reinforcement, which the rhinos were more concerned about. I don't know what we could have done to make anything more valuable than a mud pit, but because they love that mud pit. And it went, the grosser, the better, really, for those rhinos. So that's where I think I learned it mostly, and I started working with it. In terms of training with it, I would say more when I was working in the education department, and it was more directly where I was working with animals on stage. But again, I wasn't, just because of the way that the job descriptions worked there, I wasn't the actual person who was doing the training, but I would benefit from that and also be told how to reinforce what was already trained into this animal. So that was kind of nice. So I could do that with food, and I didn't use a clicker at that time, but there I got a little more hands-on experience with it. And then, of course, as a dog trainer, really delved in quite a bit more with experiencing it myself. So I think that's where it started.
Your stories are awesome.
Thank you.
Hey, just one other quick question. This is a type of question I've been asking more and more, but I'm really interested in the diversity of experiences that people bring to this podcast show before their animal training days, and how that experience, if at all, gives them a unique perspective of what they do now. So you have a master's degree in United States history. Did you ever follow that into some kind of employment or some kind of thing after your master's, or did you go straight into kind of working at a safari park? And
yes and no. I decided that's what I've always been, you know, better at English and writing, so I was trying to choose that avenue when I was in college, and picking something I would do. And I think, you know, not being certain what I liked, but I thought that I liked history. So I thought, well, that'll be neat. I do like to educate people, and I do like that feeling of giving out knowledge. So I'm going to go for my PhD, right? Simple. 1, 2, 3. So I got into a master's program, and fairly quickly, I would say within the first few months, I realized that I wasn't loving it. And graduate school is difficult anyways. And you know, your passion kind of has to pull you through it or push you through it. And I had some passion for it, but already at about the year mark, I was feeling pretty much like maybe this wasn't exactly for me, and wasn't loving it. But I really was at that point, you know, master's degree is 2 years. And so I was a year in, and I didn't really feel comfortable just giving up all entirely. I didn't have another thing that I was like, yeah, I've always been passionate about this other thing. I should really go do that. So I finished up my master's degree, and then moved back home with my parents, which, you know, is always a parent's dream. So no, they were very lovely about it. And so I moved back with them in Los Angeles and was trying to figure out, you know, what I could do with my master's degree, in an avenue that better suited me or whatever I could keep discovering about myself. And so I thought about, you know, teaching high school or teaching college, but kind of I started down that avenue, but not very far, and just realized, nope, that's not for me either. And then I moved back down to San Diego because I had friends here, frankly, and this is where I went to undergrad. And so I had some friends, and I got a couple of office jobs and really didn't like it. I think I had an office job, and it was, I think I was there for 7 weeks and called in sick 3 or 4 times. So pretty quickly I was like, yep, this isn't for me. So a friend of mine, a friend of a college friend, worked at the safari park at that time, the wild animal park. And he suggested, like, hey, you know, if you're open for getting any sort of job, it's really neat there. You get the entry level position, which might not be, you know, what everybody's going to do later, but you get an entry level position. You can kind of see what you like there. You can work with birds, you can work with mammals, you can work with plants, people, education, all these things. So I thought, wow, that's what I really need right now, is somewhere where I have a lot of options, because I didn't feel like I had any for some reason. And so I started out as a ticket seller, and that friend, you know, he recommended me to his boss. And so she gave me a chance, and that was really great. And then through there, at the Safari Park, they have programs called a loan program. So you can be in one department and they will actually loan you out to other departments that need labor. So it's a really neat opportunity. And then through that program, I was able to gain more animal experience, of which I had none at that point. So little by little, I was able to gain enough to be able to apply for jobs that required it. And I was able to get into, you know, working around bird keepers, kind of what they call an exhibit attendant. So I was doing all of that dirty work, but it was fine for me. And I learned a lot there. And then I just got closer and closer to being able to work around animals. And then in education is really when I was able to do it, that department, because you're working with humans. And so I got to do my educating. So I was finally, that felt like, I was coming full circle. I was like, oh, okay, I'm finally using my master's degree a little bit. You know, I can talk to people and I feel comfortable talking out in front of people. And I'm educating in a non-classroom sort of way, which I think is my groove. And I get to talk about animals, which is now something that I've really found that I love, and conservation that I didn't know that I loved before, that I wasn't super passionate about before, but now I really am. So that was a fun moment where everything kind of came together for me. And I was really happy in that department. And of course, things change and along the way. And I always, I don't know, there's a thing about me where I guess I feel I need to reinvent myself every few years or add on to think my knowledge. So then I started working in a few other departments, and then eventually was like, I think dog training is my thing. So fingers crossed, I'm still doing the dog training thing. I don't know what's next. Who knows? Could be anything. So I think that answers your question, but sometimes I still feel like, man, that master's degree, what am I using that for? Especially in dog training now. But I think it does enable me to be able to, you know, think, you know, outside the box. Sometimes I learned that as a graduate student, thinking of things in different ways, analyzing, you know, and then of course just to get in the business part, I learned how to write really well in graduate school. And so now I can use that to write blogs, and I can write my newsletter and those kinds of businessy things that aren't as, you know, I guess fun, but I don't have to suffer through that part of my business. So that's kind of nice too.
So bring everyone listening up to speed then. Where can they go to find out more about you now and your blogs and everything else that you're using your degree for in 2018?
You can find me. I'm at www.theproficientpup.com. lynnbeck.com. So that's my website where you can kind of see who I am and what I do. I do have a Facebook page that's just called the Proficient Pup Dog Training and Massage. And I'm on Instagram at the Proficient Pup. And I think that's all of my avenues right now.
Fantastic. And we'll link to all of that in the show write-up as well if you want to navigate to the ATA website to easily find all of those things. Hey, thank you so much for sharing everything so far, Lynn. We love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys here at this show, and your one is definitely unique, very interesting, full of swinging giraffe heads and United States history.
Right. Who knew they could go together?
Well, moving forward, we'd really like to discuss what we briefly mentioned in your bio there, and that is snake aversion training, or rather alternatives to this.
Yes.
As this is something you offer your clients there in California, isn't it? But before we do, I just wanted to be transparent about our offering of information. Can you just tell people about your experience learning about this and what your journey's been like from that time until now, where you've added that service to your offerings?
I would say that when I became a dog trainer, really, I was just focused on learning how to do that, how to train dogs. And as I gained some knowledge and skill in that, I felt like I could maybe branch out a little bit. And like I mentioned before, I've always been interested, not always, but at least the past 20 years, interested really in conservation. And through as an educator at the park, I was able to work with snakes, which I hadn't done before, and really came to appreciate them. And of course, it was my knowledge to, give information to guests so they weren't always running and screaming every time they saw a snake. And then if they did, I could try to get them to understand maybe a little bit about why they were doing that and why they didn't really necessarily have to, and that they could stop and actually enjoy looking at a snake from afar. And so I was trying to work some ways of working conservation, my passion for conservation and my love of conservation, into dog training. And that can be a difficult task in some ways. But I at least like to do it for myself. I don't push it on necessarily my clients too much, although I don't know. So I just started, as I found out more about the shock community, and I saw, was looking at rattlesnake avoidance training, or as it may be called, aversion training. I prefer avoidance, but we'll talk a little bit more about that. So as I looked at that, first I saw that shock was being used. So of course, right there, that's not my ideology and that's not my methodology. And so right there, I already have an issue with people who train dogs that way. And then secondly, I started to learn about what was going on with the snake. And that was my other concern. And I don't know that that is always people's concern about what's happening with the snake at that time. And so there are different things that trainers for, I don't necessarily think what they're doing is training. So I'm calling them trainers, but the people who use shock to train that aversion are using live snakes, and they're using rattlesnakes. And so if people are not familiar with rattlesnakes in this area, those are our venomous snakes. We're actually pretty fortunate to have snakes that make noise and that will let us know, hey, stay away from me. There's a lot of parts of the world, of course, where venomous snakes are silent. So at any rate, they were using these snakes and they were capturing them from the wild and then using them as a kind of the thing to avoid. And so, and through that training, they were either allowing the dog to walk up very closely to these snakes before shocking them, or just being around them. So what's going on with the snake at that time really started to get into my brain about what's happening with that snake. So sometimes people will remove the fangs or pull out. So obviously that's, at least in my mind, that's cruel. Or sew the snake's mouth shut, or tape it shut, or hood it, all of which would be very either painful or stress-inducing for the snake. So you then have to think about how that affects the snake's behavior, and again, how that's going to be affecting the dog's behavior. And I'll we can get a little bit more into scent later. But at any rate, so as I started to think about these things, I thought, gosh, is there a better way? Can there be a way, better way? There has to be a better way. And I found somebody locally, Pamela Johnson, who was teaching some positive reinforcement snake, rattlesnake avoidance. And so I got a little group together, and she was nice enough to teach us a little weekend class, a weekend seminar at her place that's about an hour away from me, but an hour and a half is totally worth it. So learned a lot in that weekend about how I could be able to set up my own class and be able to teach my own clients about that, which is great. So she was willing, her message is not only to teach clients, but also to teach other trainers to be able to do this as well. So that was really, really neat. And so once I had that information, then the issue was, well, how do I market this and how do I get people to go for it? So, and I'm, you know, I guess 2 years later, I'm still in that process of how do I get people to get on board with that. But it's a process. So I'm getting more calls than I used to. So that's a good thing. Yeah, I think that I'm answering your question.
So with your journey, because there were a couple of people that did the Pamela Johnson weekend with you. Is that correct?
Yes.
And are the other people, Phoebe's here as well, just in case anyone's wondering who's trying to button and presenting this podcast today. And are those other people now also doing snake aversion? Or?
They're in that seminar that I recall, there were maybe 10 of us, and I'm not sure if other people ended up using that themselves. Some were from LA, some were here locally. There were only, I know Pamela is still, as far as I am aware, she's still teaching that. And then there's another person who's on, more on the coast. I'm what's called inland San Diego. So that person's more on the coast, and she was teaching some classes, but I think she's taking kind of a break on that for right now, from what I understand. So as far as I'm aware, there's really only two of us in all of San Diego County. And there's a lot of positive reinforcement trainers here, comparatively, I would say a lot. But only two of us that I know that are actively really training that or trying to train that. And, but I don't know about everybody in that took that class, what they're doing.
So two things. Firstly, sorry, I called it snake aversion then, but you highlighted that you wanted to potentially discuss the difference in your mind between the word aversion and avoidance. And also, why do you think there's only two trainers in that area? Because I imagine there's more than two rattlesnakes. That came out really silly sounding. But there's lots of snakes there, is basically what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. You know, I can't say for sure, but I do know that when I started kind of delving into it a little bit more and asking trainers about it, I think that some trainer, I can't speak for everybody, but I did talk to a couple of trainers who were just nervous about maybe the liability of teaching a dog or teaching people to keep their dog away from a possibly fatal injury. But I never felt that myself. I never felt that fear, I guess, of that liability. I already feel like there's liability when I walk into somebody's home and I'm teaching them things about their dog, because I don't really necessarily know their follow through. I don't know how hard they're going to work. I don't know if they're going to keep up on the things I'm teaching them. So maybe they have a door dasher and they don't want their dog to be running out that door. So I'm going to try and help them learn a solid weight at the door or a solid recall. But that will only go so far. And so that after I'm done, after they say, hey, we're good enough and thanks for everything, then they may not keep up with that. And then their dog may dash out that door and get hit by a car. So which to me, it's far more likely a car is going to be driving by than a snake is going to be on a sidewalk. But I don't have necessarily the statistics for that. But I've seen a lot of cars and I've seen more cars than I've seen snakes. And I've seen, more dogs in the road than I have actually seen snakes in the road. So so I think that might be some of it, that maybe some trainers feel some trepidation there about going down that road or trying to, worrying about possible fatalities on the other end if, there it you know, if it didn't, if the behaviors are not as solid as we are teaching them to be. Does that make sense?
It does. So we're still in 2018 kind of gaining knowledge from what you're doing, but also you had a discussion about this and there potentially might be, but to the best of our ability, not much data either on the effectiveness of shock collar use and how successful that is with keeping dogs alive. So this is a bit of an exploratory conversation, isn't it? One where we're asking that question that we should be asking with absolutely everything we do, in my personal opinion. How can we do this better? How can we be less intrusive with our animals?
No, I think that's true. You know, we are working with some gaps in our own knowledge and statistics and all those great sciencey things that that help us make decisions. But there are, you know, we can just work with the things that we do know. So we do know that shock has fallout. We do know that taping an animal's mouth shut or sewing it closed is going to cause pain or stress. You know, we do know, there are the things that we don't know, right? Where we don't know anything about, or I would say we know very little about what snakes smell like to a dog, or that if different species smell different, which would make sense to me. But again, haven't found that information, or whether each individual unique snake has their own scent, which to me would also maybe make sense. But again, I don't have that information. So I just try and use the things that, you know, we do know and work off of that. And of course, things can always change as we gain information, just like always. So, you know, even I was trying to look up just the statistics of how many snakes are in the United States, for example, are bitten. Sorry, how many dogs are bitten by snakes? And then, you know, how many are venomous? And then what's the result of those venomous bites? And there really isn't a database for that. So again, some lack of knowledge there. So I can only use what seems obvious, which isn't necessarily scientific, but at least I can look around and say, okay, well, again, it's far more likely in my mind, again, not having the science behind to back it up, but that a dog can get hit by a car, or that a dog's going to get in a fight with another dog and have a fatal injury, or all of the other things that you might see in a vet room or a hospital, as opposed to the snake bites, which stand out, I think, probably because, you know, in people's mind, that's more scary. You can't control that as much as maybe people feel they can control the other things. I don't know if that's what it is, but definitely people seem to react more to the danger of a snake, rare as though it might be, than the other more obvious hazards. So that's kind of how I just go with what I can.
Yeah, cool. Really well put, Lynn. And then to build on that and moving forward, you and I caught up a few weeks ago and we were thinking about the best way to present the information that you wanted to share with the podcast audience about how you approach this with everything, taking into consideration everything that you've shared so far. And we came up with a list of 10 things that you want to, or information that you want to share with people wanting to train this and behaviors, et cetera, that we can train. So do you want to go through that list for us, Lynn, one by one?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Okay, so number one, so we're not really training aversion. So I maybe it's just the word, but I feel differently from aversion than avoidance. And it's not even that either. So I feel like it really isn't about the snake itself. So I do educate people about snakes, because that's what they're hiring me, is specifically for rattlesnake avoidance. If I just said hazard avoidance, I'd probably get even less people. So, but it's not about the snake. It's about using behaviors to avoid those things that we feel are dangerous. So, and, you know, I'll be outlining kind of what those behaviors are that I pay attention to or focus on, but it's not about training fear. I don't really want the dogs to feel fear. I work with a lot of dogs that already have a ton of fear, so I don't need to add to that. And it doesn't, in my mind, make sense. So it's not about how they fear the snake. It's about how they're going to really be responding to you as their owner or trainer, or handler. And so we're really teaching the dog and training stimulus control on their end, rather than just, I want you to avoid that thing. Because I feel like that's almost too myopic to just look at it as only the snake. So if I wanted them to, you know, be aware of an orange cone, I could put an orange cone out somewhere and use these same behaviors to stay away from the orange cone. The orange cone's not going to do anything to that dog. So the dog does not need to fear orange cones. And I don't want the dog to fear orange cones in general. But I want to be able to work with the dog so that they can listen to me to be able to stay away from something I see as dangerous and I interpret as a hazard, not what the dog interprets as a hazard, because they see things and understand things in a different way than how I do. So it doesn't have to, again, be about the snake. It's about the hazard that's around in that environment.
Awesome. So number one, realizing we're not training aversion, we're just training the avoidance of dangerous things. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. Avoiding the things that we see as dangerous.
Yes. Yeah. From our perspective.
Right, exactly.
But we're not teaching them to not like those things. We're just teaching them to do behaviors that keep proximity from those things.
Right. Because I don't know if I can teach something, a dog, to like or dislike something, except through fear or pain or training, like avoidance in that way or an aversion in that way. So it's avoidance in my mind, and any other person's perspective is going to be like, I want them to avoid X. But it's going to be more about like turning it to, I want the dog to be able to focus on me in the presence of X. I want the dog to turn to me in the presence of X, which they might not even see. They might not even know is there, but I do. So I'm not going to wait for the dog to sit there and decide, huh, do I like that thing or do I not like that thing? Let me remember. You know, have I ever experienced a bad situation when seeing that thing? No. Well, it was a long time ago. I don't know that that's necessarily even going on in the dog's brain. So I kind of want to work around that instead. And it's really about the dog's focus on me.
Sounds very obvious when you frame it that way. Now, number two is you want to let people know, and I really like this, that you appreciate, and this potentially is just something that goes for all training. You want people to know that there's no guarantees. You can't leave there and go, cool, your dog has been trained to avoid snakes. You will never have to worry about snakes again.
Right, exactly. Like I can't even imagine ever saying that really about anything. I don't ever finish up with a client and say, okay, and clap my hands together and be like, you're good to go and you are protected from everything and your dog will always listen to you and so have a nice day. So I think there are many of us dog trainers who don't guarantee anything anyways. It's just not you to guarantee a behavior. You could never guarantee a behavior. So for this, again, there is no guarantee that your dog's not going to get bit by a snake or that it's not going to face some other hazards. But you're greatly reducing the probability, I think, by interacting with your dog in such a way so that they can listen to you and can focus on you in the presence of those things. The way that it works with training is that you're trying to work with the environment. So, right, behavior is affected by the environment around, and there's some you can, through management, you can actually change to decrease behavior or to increase behavior. You can manipulate the environment, but sometimes you can't. So you work with what you've got. So although there might be some people that want to eliminate every rattlesnake in the world, so that, or at least in San Diego County, so there's never a threat for their dog. First of all, that doesn't make sense ecologically. But secondly, I understand the passion of wanting to keep your dog safe, but it's not sustainable. It doesn't work that way. So you're not going to create environment free of rattlesnakes. And then even if you did, there's going to be the next threat. Well, let me make sure there's no coyotes ever around. Okay, what's the next threat? Let me make sure there's never a raccoon, that might be cross or whatever. So you're never going to eliminate every single threat. So you have to find a different way to work around those hazards and threats and work it a different way so that you can protect your dog in a more sustainable way, really.
Mm. And you were saying that you're aware that this is the same, that the same message that people who are using shock to train this in your area are potentially giving their clients anyway. So your clients are faced with a decision of like quick 15-minute some guy telling me that he's going to do something to my dog that's horrible that might not work. This long, lengthy learning process. Is that, do you think, I'm just trying to see it from your potential client's perspective. Is this possibly what they're thinking?
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. Like, I think people, and I've talked to people that are either interested in, you know, they want the results. They want their dog to be safe, obviously. They want their dog not to have that threat of possibly being bitten and possibly dying. So they're trying to, you know, it's coming from a place where they obviously care about a lot about their dog and keeping the dog safe. And so I think, yes, when the shock trainers are offering, some, you know, a quick 15-minute drop off your dog, pick them up or watch what's going on and you're done. And from what I've seen, there are no guarantees on their end. So they don't guarantee because they're not stupid. They're not going to guarantee that the dog will never get bit by a snake because they're not having every kind of snake in every kind of scenario, in every kind of position in, you know, they're not really proofing anything. So, or generalizing anything for the dog. The fear is getting generalized and, you know, and obviously again, we know all about fallout from using shock. So, but right, there's no guarantee there. So I still feel though, from what I understand from even people who've done it, although they didn't like that their dog was yelping or appeared to be in pain, they didn't like that, but the ends justified the means because now they feel like, oh, okay, it's still better. Just in case the dog sees a snake, the dog's going to know what to do, which again, there's no guarantees, but I don't think the people who are training that are explaining what that means, what that not lack of guarantee means. It just essentially means this may not work. And in addition to that, along with their lack of a guarantee is going to be the need they stress, or most of them do, I can't say all, the need for a quote unquote refresher in a year. So whether they do that because it's a way for them to make money and have a client come back to them, or they themselves know that this training, it doesn't really work. Essentially, it's not going to work if they need a refresher like that in a year. So the way I think of the training that I do is that you don't need a refresher. It's just something that becomes part of your lifestyle and part of what you do. So yes, you have to, just like anything, you have to keep up with the training of your dog. You can't just teach them a recall and then not do it for a year and then expect your dog to come when called. So I guess it's the same way, but I wouldn't call that a refresher. It's just keeping up with the training that you're being taught. So, but the refresher that the shock trainers are offering, it almost to me looks like they know that maybe this shock isn't really, it's not effective. It's an admission that it's not effective.
So this is kind of point number four we talked about. Is it setting realistic goals around training behavior? Is it the right title to put this idea under, that it's a thinking process that you just employ into your life as opposed to?
Yeah, I think so. So, right. So the realistic expectations of training any behavior, and I think a lot of trainers out there realize this, whether you work in a zoo or what capacity you're working in as a dog professional dog trainer or just someone who likes to train their dog at home, you know, you realize just with any behavior, even human behavior, you have to keep up with it. If you don't use it, you lose it, right? That's our expression that we have that essentially means that if you're not continuing with your practicing, then your skills are going to decrease. That's just the way it is. And the more you practice, the more skill you can have at anything. So I can't expect that I'm going to learn how to play piano on, you know, that I learn. And if I don't keep up with it every week, at the end of 6 months, I'm going to be where my teacher, you know, initially said I could be. I can't expect that. Or that a year later, I'm going to be able to play a piece that I haven't practiced on in a year. That doesn't make any sense. And we would acknowledge that doesn't make sense. And anybody who said they could do that, we would highly doubt. So I think it is setting realistic goals around training behavior. You have to let your clients know, or even, you know, if you work in a zoo, you need to let people higher up know, because sometimes for those people who work in shows or anything else in a zoo, and the higher ups who don't necessarily do a lot of training themselves might say, I would like a brand new show from you in 3 months or 2 months. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, okay, what kind of behaviors can I train in that amount of time to be able to get fluency and to be able to put on a good show? And you realize that training takes time and you have to set realistic goals. And so I think that's important for us to also let our clients know that as well. And from what I see, the most clients do understand that, even if they're not necessarily, they don't have the commitment within themselves, they recognize that they need it.
So I was looking at resources versus goals and finding the alignment or non-alignment of those two things.
Okay.
So as I want my dog to avoid all of these things, and I have $100 to pay you in total, and I want to do it in 2 weeks because then I'm going on holiday. It's kind of looking at those things and weighing up. Is that what you're saying with that?
Yeah, I think that person called me a couple weeks ago. No, absolutely. And I'm really straightforward when I talk to people on the phone, because I do get expectations of, you know, oh, I have 100 acres and I just want my dog to be outside and be able to, if they see a snake, just to be able to walk away or not deal with it. And really, like, I do explain that that's not really how I'm training. I'm not training that. I'm not training a dog to be able to make a decision on their own while I'm not around as to whether how dangerous an animal in front of them is going to be. So, you know, some dogs may have that instinct to stay away or a natural fear response, and some don't. Some have a natural curiosity response. And so, you know, working with that individual dog and be able to train that. I mean, I think I don't, not that it maybe couldn't be done, but I certainly way beyond my capacity and a skill and knowledge set. But so I do let them know, you know, if they need to be willing to make some changes either in their lifestyle or the environment or the way they manage that environment in order to keep their dog safe.
Awesome. So number one, realize we're training avoidance of what we perceive to be dangerous things. Two, there's no guarantees. Four, on our list, set realistic goals around training behavior. And a lot of these are just generic training things. So we're coming into this snake avoidance thing with just common sense, basically, right?
Yeah.
And so number three is a little bit more specific.
Okay.
To snakes. However, if we're thinking about just avoidance training or training in general, we've got to educate ourselves about the things surrounding the training we're going to do with our dogs. So number three is educate yourself, educate the clients about snakes. How important to you is that when you're working with these clients? And when you say educate about snakes, like how in depth are you going? Are you teaching them the genus of the snakes? what do you mean by this?
I keep it as basic as I can. So, and I keep it about things that they care about. So, I'm not even going into how can you identify a venomous snake from a non-venomous snake. I don't even worry about that because they're going to see snake. And I don't want them to sit there and take the time and go, well, did you see a rattle? You know, what does it look like? And what are the markings? When you're faced with a threat, you don't have time to sit there and think those things through and go, oh, okay, wait, I don't need to worry about this one because it doesn't look venomous. You don't want your dog bit by a snake anyways, even if it's non-venomous, right? It's still going to hurt, still going to bleed, open to infection, etc. So it doesn't matter. I don't really care if it's venomous or non-venomous. I just want to teach them a little bit about snake behavior, because some people really do believe that a snake is going to be able to you know, leap out at them 15 feet and, you know, attack their jugular and open up their throat and whatever else they have in their minds about what snakes are capable of. And, you know, the snakes that we have around here, at least in San Diego County, are not capable of really jumping, or they don't live in trees. They're not going to drop down on you. So I like to let people know, well, first of all, snakes really want nothing to do with you. And that's kind of the whole point of the rattle. So if you hear a rattle, just be happy and thankful that the snake is communicating in a way to say back off, and then listen to that snake. But not all snakes will rattle at all times. And so also being aware that at least the snakes here in San Diego County can be found in the beaches, they can be found in parks, they can be found, you know, just on the road, they can be found in the mountains, around rocks, all sorts of places. So, you know, not to get complacent and just to think, well, I'm at the beach, so it won't matter, I won't see a rattlesnake, or any other snake. So giving them information about what kind of environments they live in, what kind of behaviors snakes are apt to, which would be because they're ectothermic, and I wouldn't say I get that fancy with people. I just say, you know, they tend to want to come out when it's a bit warmer. So you might find them at the end of the day out in more open spaces, trying to get that last bit of warmth of the day. You know, other times when it's the height of the day, you might find them more hidden underneath bushes, and, you know, around rocks, things like that. So just letting people know a little bit about snake behavior in general that might help them, give them contextual cues when they're out hiking with their dog or whatever, so that they can recognize certain habitats where they might be more likely to see a snake. So that's what I want to teach them as well, giving them contextual cues as well so they can be prepared. Because they may be surprised, you know, at any time seeing a snake. It can be surprising, especially because you may not have seen them all the time, or you see them every once in a while. It's a surprise when they're there. And also really to let people know too about what goes hand in hand with educating yourself about snake behaviors is ways to manage your own yard. I kind of fit that in there as well, like a little bit of management information education too. Like, are they able to manage with snake fencing, with they being able to protect the space of their yard? Do they have a yard where they just let the dogs out? And can they just go canvas that yard really quick before they let their dog out? Things like that. So you want to look out for threats. You want to reduce the possibility of threats as much as possible. And again, basing that knowledge on what snakes' capabilities are.
Awesome. So I guess at this stage, someone's come to you and we haven't even started talking about training yet. and so I guess they've got their expectations about what your interaction was going to go like, and you've provided all of this information to kind of just, is this process kind of to match up where that client is and the resources and the compatibility of what you're offering, and if they're open to it? Because we talked about, okay, we're going to be training avoidance, not aversion. There's no guarantees here. We've got to do some self-education about snakes, and we've got to look at being realistic about what we can train with the resources we have. Is this a conversation you have with clients before you start to talk about the training?
Some of it. I'm a little more brief, but yeah, essentially, I kind of run through. I give them the basics of, you know, it's going to be 5 classes, and, you know, it's in your home, in your area. For the clients who might have that issue that it's their backyard or their space, they're not worried about being out on a path somewhere, then I say, great, that's great. We can work within your yard, because that's incredibly contextual for your dog. That's going to make a lot of sense to train right there in that yard. If it's a matter of being worried, being anywhere and everywhere, then again, it's just, they would have to work on a lot of that stuff without me, because the 5 classes are not going to be able to include, you know, trips to the beach and the mountains and the desert and all that stuff. So I don't really go fully into everything, but I do like to give them just that basic overview of what I am going to be offering them and what their expectations are.
And then you go on to talk about behavior. So number 5 is you've got A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. seven behaviors that we discussed, and then, you know, this isn't a list that is including absolutely everything. Obviously, we can remove some of those or add some of those for whatever our situation is. But can you talk through some of the behaviors, what we've labeled as solid behaviors that you want to
control? So solid behaviors are things that you might teach just, you know, in general dog training, and people call up for general behaviors. But a recall, obviously a really solid recall, of being able to call your dog back whenever you ask. And in the presence of different kinds of distractions. So I do, one of my last class or the last couple of classes, the last couple of sessions will be with snake, you know, decoys or props that I have. But again, the understanding is that that's not every shape of every kind of snake that we have here, and not in every position. So trying to teach that recall enough so that they can understand it and understand the importance and keep it simple for them, but also being able to help them learn how to generalize it when we're done with the five classes. Because again, that's going to be something, the ability of that dog to be able to recall in different, with different distractions, is going to vary based on how much they're training on their own part. So that's one. Then leave it. That's always a good one. Again, just for general, leave it is great for any, avoiding any sort of hazard that you might have around. So why not use it for snake training as well? The snake avoidance training. So again, asking just a dog if they're going up, maybe they're just going to go sniff a bush. So you didn't teach them to be afraid of a bush. You don't want them sticking their nose underneath that bush. So that's where you can give a nice leave it. And then, you know, they come back to you and you give them a treat. Another one would be a collar grab. And I added onto that being able to run up to the dog. So a collar grab, even with movement. So many dogs have an aversion to being grabbed by the collar because either it was done as a puppy or it's been done to grab them and put them somewhere. If a dog's been in a shelter, sometimes, you know, people need to be able to grab a dog quickly. And so they grab them by the collar, and it can be very aversive to a dog. So again, we want to teach that so you can, you forgot recall and you forgot leave it. You forgot how to do all those. So your basic is, I'm going to grab my dog, because your brain is now working in maybe a not a thinking mind. You're just, I see something I don't like. I got to grab my dog. So you want to be able to grab your dog by the collar and not have it move away from you right into the snake, which is exactly where you didn't want it to go. So also teaching people to be able to grab a dog by collar safely and not have it spook the dog. And training the dog that that's an okay thing, and being also able to run up to that dog a little bit with some movement. Another one I like is easy, just hand targeting. That's super simple for people. It's a basic one that I teach any client, but being able to teach that hand targeting, which can then turn into a way to, for a dog to follow your hand away from the threat. And again, assuming either the dog has seen the animal and seen the snake and is just curious and you want to direct attention away, and giving them people that option to use that simple targeting and moving. Another one would be, which could be a little bit, it requires a little bit more training. So it depends on people's, again, their commitment and involvement of teaching the dog to go behind them or between their legs or something like that. One that I go along with that, depending on how I'm reading my client, I might just have a simple walk backwards. Walk backwards, have the dog, you know, call the dog. So you're using a little bit of a recall, but you're also using your own movement to get the dog to come with you. Again, pretty simple that many people are for. Then also teaching a wait, which is, again, another really strong, great behavior to have in general, but another one that allows us to just, again, be like, oh, I don't know what to do. I've forgotten all of the tools in my basket, and all I can do is ask the dog to stop. That's all I want, is the dog to wait. And so until I can think for a second of what is happening. And so that's always a nice one too, just getting the dog to understand like, oh, I'm waiting. Okay. You know, you're going to let me go. Am I waiting for my release, or am I waiting for you to take me a different direction? And then also, this is sort of like almost an emergency recall or a recall with a different cue. It's just using a scared response from you that might mean, depending on what you want value or what meaning you want to put on it, it could mean stop or wait or even a come, even a recall. And that would be whatever you would do when you saw a snake yourself, because you might gasp or intake your breath or curse, whatever your choice of panic might be, expression of panic. and then have the dog be able to hear that and then look towards you. And then you've got the dog's focus. So whether it's just you're looking for them to pay attention to you, or maybe that gasp means come. And so teaching that as well can be very helpful. So I know with my dog, we had just a non-venomous snake in the backyard, and she happened to just be staring at it. She was standing there staring. I looked over at her and I was like, that's a strange behavior. So I went over to her. Same thing. I'm not really afraid of snakes, but it was still surprising to me. And so I saw her, saw the snake, which took me a while to see the snake. Obviously, they have a lot of camouflage and blend in really well. That's the whole point. And so I stopped and I just went, and so she kind of stopped for a second and looked at me. And then that gave me the moment. And again, even I was like, what am I doing? I want to grab my dog. That was my go-to. So I just grabbed her by the collar nice and smoothly and calmly as I could. And I said, let's go inside. And we just walked in. And that was it. And then I went back outside and looked at the snake and took pictures and did some more observations. But and it was nice. She didn't have to panic. It didn't make her run into the snake. And so, that was good for me. So, but those tend to be my go-tos. I want to keep it really simple for the client, things that they can do, things that when they panic, they're going to have access to one of those. If you've got a basket of, 8 things to do, then at least you can grab one of them. If you only have one or two at your option, you're going to forget both and you won't even know what you're doing. So.
Awesome. Thanks for all of that. It's interesting to think about, even if you are educated about snakes, you just don't, when you're not expecting it, you're going to have that kind of reflective response.
Absolutely.
It's a great list there. So just to run through them again, good recall, good leave it, collar grabs, hand targeting, walking backwards, teaching weight, and teaching a scared response from you as a cue for look at you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is a very useful list of behaviors for many different contexts.
Exactly.
Which is number 6 on our list, and you've already talked about this, so I'm not sure if you want to say, as I've already said, or you want to build on what you've already said, but this is to generalize this, and you wanted to highlight that this doesn't happen in aversion training. So you take your dog to a car park, it gets shocked with a live snake there, that's it. So it might go, okay, cool, there's a live snake in the car park, I avoid it, but when it's out in the park and it sees a live snake, it hasn't been generalized to that behavior.
Sure, that's absolutely. That context. Yeah, absolutely. Because maybe when they were shocked, there happened to be a bicycle there. So now they're like, well, the bicycle has to be present in order for me to be worried about this thing. And, like I said, we already know about a lot of fallout from shock and a lot of fear that does get generalized from that. But when we're training with positive reinforcement, we want to be able to generalize the good feelings. And so in the case of snakes, what I use because I'm not using a real snake, I have not said that since the beginning. So I don't use snakes. I don't think it's ethical to capture them from the wild. And here in San Diego, although you don't need a permit to do that, to take them out of their habitat, with the exception of one species that you're not allowed to. But once you have them in your care, you can't re-release them. And you actually are not even allowed to be using them commercially. So, and I don't know all the rules. I know there's ways to get around rules and things, but I think that training a class is using it commercially, using those snakes commercially. However, I digress. So in my training, because I'm not using snakes, I'm just using sounds that I find on an app of rattles. But again, all snakes are not going to be rattling. All those rattlesnakes are not going to be rattling. And they're not even going to be rattling in the same exact way. So you just use what you can. Some rattles are going to be faster than others, louder than others, etc. I use visual decoys, again, just using what I can. Some little decoys I've bought on Amazon of either snakes with their mouths open or closed or coiled up or extended. Also using something moving. So I do have one that's a little floppier, a little rubber snake that I can, tie a little piece of wire to, or line, plastic line, and be able to kind of manipulate it or move it from a distance so that maybe the dog doesn't associate the movement of the snake with me. But again, something different that they might see. And just doing what you can and to vary those environments that the dog is in. And then just essentially with any behavior that you want to become solid, you just try to think as many ways that you can the context in which these behaviors would be seen, or the hazard would be seen, and then training those behaviors to correspond with that threat.
I like it. I feel like potentially we could say thus far we've just been talking about how to do some good dog training, and it would apply to snakes as well. Yeah. Apart from the educate yourself about snakes part. So number one, realize your training avoidance is not aversion. Number two, appreciate there's no guarantees. This is what you're telling clients. Number three, educate people about snakes at a basic level. Number four, set realistic goals about training. When are we training? Good recalls, leave it, collar grabs, hand targeting, walking backwards, teaching weight. Teaching us being scared as a cue for trained behaviors. Number six is we want to generalize, get creative. You just said some really creative ways that you've managed to incorporate resources into your training. And I'm sure people have their own ideas and we can build upon that. And just with creativity, obviously, you never stop. So get creative is my point. Number seven is maintenance.
Yes. So maintaining that, I did touch on this earlier, so that no need for a refresher, really, if you're just practicing these behaviors all the time and your goal is to get them to be solid and they're just everyday behaviors. So just basically keep practicing them and they become stronger and you can practice all year round on all these sorts of different things. So when you did say like, it just seems like this is just basic good dog training, like really that's it. That's the point, is it's just basic good dog training. And like I said, has little to do with a specific threat as well as any kind of threat that you might pass by. So you're going to want those behaviors anytime instead of just the summer when it's warmer or whatever. And particularly here in San Diego, it stays warm all the time, all the year. So, you know, it's November right now and it's a little cooler today, maybe in 75 or 80, but yesterday it was close to 90 degrees. And so, we get a lot of warm weather here. So there's no guarantee either of when those snakes are going to be apparent, because there are many times of the year that when it's warm enough for them to be out and about.
So good training, good dog training with a little bit of education about snakes.
There you go.
But number eight is potentially a little bit more focused on the snakes conversation, and that's about more to do with management and using collar and leads. Can you speak to this, Lynn?
Yeah, this is huge for me, and more than likely a lot of people, well, I won't say a lot, but some people may not agree, and that's okay. But I'm big on using a collar or a harness, really, and a lead, always having your dog on a leash for the most part, with, you know, maybe exceptions for sports events and those kinds of things. But if you're just walking your dog and walking on a hike, and even if it's an area where dogs are allowed off leash, to me, again, there's just so many threats. And again, it depends how solid, if you feel really secure that your dog's got some great recall, and, you know, then fine, you might be able to balance that risk with what you know your dog's going to respond to. But for most people, I let them know, like, this is the way I train. I am training you this to be taking place while you have your dog on leash. And I can't blame people. They really want that feeling of, oh, my dog is, you know, having so much fun off leash. And I'm going to get into this a little bit later, but they want their dogs to have that quote unquote freedom. And sure, there is, you know, the dog is going to enjoy itself until it doesn't. And again, the dog is not necessarily aware of the list of threats that we are in that habitat. So the dog's going to be having a groovy time until they aren't. And so I think some of that is common sense, but I do understand that people are looking for a certain experience with their dog. And I don't like to suppress that, but I do want to give them information to make good decisions themselves so that they can then say, okay, I get it. And I'm going to try and balance this out for myself. I don't want to force a dog. I don't want to force a human to be one way or another.
And so number nine is potentially building on the same thread of educating people about snakes, but we're educating humans about how to identify risks better as well. Do you have anything to add to that, or do you think we've covered the majority of number nine, which is walking training for the human, teaching them to identify risks better on walks and what a safe walk looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, we did just hit a little bit on that. But again, balancing the having fun versus staying safe and what that looks like to any individual, and what they need to do to ensure their own pet's safety with the individual dog that they have on the end of their leash or not on the end of their leash. And so the abilities of that dog, the size of that dog, the capability of that dog, the learning experience of that dog. So that is an individual thing as well. But also, again, learning what snake habitat looks like and making sure they understand that. And then that where those dogs are more likely to be in those habitats. And then understanding what to do, which goes into number 10, understanding a bit about what to do if you do find the snakes in those areas. You want me to go ahead to number 10?
I want you to take us on a journey of your awesomeness.
Oh my God, what have I been doing this so far? Okay. All right. So yes, number 10, here's the journey of my awesomeness continued. So having that plan in case of that emergency. So now you've learned all the things that you need to know to identify your risks. You've taken your precautions. You've balanced out your, the fun you want to have versus staying safe. And then you have a plan, a just in case emergency plan. So that might include some immunization for your dog, although again, lacking the statistics and knowledge, there's not a whole lot known about the efficacy of those immunizations. So if you're going to get your dog immunized, you of course talk to your vet about the pros and cons and what those might be and how effective that they feel the immunization to a rattlesnake is. Also having your vet emergency number with you just in case anything goes wrong, boom, you can talk to them right away. You want to make sure most people have phones on them all the time anyways, but take a photo of the snake because you may not remember what it looked like and they will likely need to know in order to get the appropriate antivenin that your dog may need. And so that information is going to be crucial. So that is a hard one, but if you can prepare yourself in advance, like I need to take a photo, it's not probably the moment that you're feeling like you want to take a photo, but a photo of the snake will definitely help you. And also just know where a local emergency vet is. So if you are wanting to try a new path or a new trail, just find out where there's an emergency vet nearby. And it just cuts down. That's just cutting down the amount of time it's going to take you to have to hunt that number down after the fact. Because really, you're just going to want to get your dog in the car and go. Speaking of getting your dog in the car then too is ensuring that you'll be able to get your dog into the car without any help. If you don't have any, you could be by yourself on a pathway somewhere. Can you pick and lift up your dog and take them to your car? Does your dog weigh 100 pounds and it's going to be difficult for you to do that and the dog won't be able to walk? That's something to think about. It's just something to consider. It doesn't mean you can't ever go for a walk with your 100-pound dog, but it just means, maybe again, weighing those things out in your head where you're like, wow, maybe my 100, I won't be able to help my big heavy dog that I won't be able to lift and carry a mile out back to the parking lot. So maybe this is what I need to know to keep my dog on leash. So maybe not having my dog on leash is no longer an option in the reality of thinking of that. So it's just stuff to think about and be prepared for.
So it's kind of like doing some planning before you do a training session so that you can minimize your decision points when you're in a real life situation.
Yes, exactly.
And you said
right, exactly. Having the information at your fingertips as much as possible.
And you said in the number 9, balancing having fun with staying safe. So, I mean, this kind of brings us full circle when we get to number 10, because that was exactly what I feel you were doing in the safari park with those giant giraffe heads coming into your vehicles.
Oh, yes. We came full circle back to the giraffes.
Do you like what I did there?
Yeah, I like it. Look at your journey of awesomeness. That's absolutely. So, so that's what I think about is that how to, create safety at the same time that you can have fun. And so sometimes, just like in our own lives where there are people who are less risk aversive and there are people who are more risk aversive and, are willing to try things or willing to balance that out and the fun outweighs the risk and all those sorts of things. So we have to make those decisions all the time for ourselves. And so we're just doing it as one other aspect of our life is with our pets. But I think the reality is, as you start to learn more about the environment and the environment you're in, that it's not necessarily what you might have thought it was, then you're better able to balance out the reality of fun versus safety.
Beautifully said. Let's run through that list one more time. And additionally, before we do that and after we do that, and before we do end the podcast, express gratitude to you for sharing this journey of awesomeness with us today. the 10 things are: realizing we're training avoidance, not aversion, avoidance of things that we perceive as dangerous, appreciate there's no guarantees, educate people about snakes, educate yourself about snakes, set realistic goals around training behaviors, and solid behaviors you can train are good recall, good lever, collar grabs, hand target, walk backwards, teach a weight behavior, and teach a response to you, the human, being scared, and more. Generalize, maintain, use collars and leads, train yourself to identify risks better on walks, what safe walks look like, and have a contingency plan in place in case the worst possible scenario happens. Anything else to add on that? It's pretty extensive, and it's pretty in line with the journey of awesomeness. It is a list of awesomeness.
Great. I'm just going to market it that way now. Come with me on my journey of awesomeness.
Yeah, you should have a blog post called Journey of Awesomeness to Teach Your Dogs to Be Safe in California. Nice.
I like it.
Anything you want to add on that before we wrap up? I mean, that's so much food for thought for the podcast audience, but any final thoughts on that list?
Yeah, no, I think it's fairly comprehensive. And I think that kind of wraps up a whole bunch of the stuff that kind of goes through my head and to try and organize this, which again is really like, it's not too crazy.
Yeah. It's an interesting one, isn't it? To sell to the person who might not have experience of training and the knowledge and information surrounding behavior to be offered by us a journey of awesomeness, which was operationalized by all the things we just talked about, versus, hey, come and I'll fix your dog in 15 minutes.
Right. Right. And again, that ends seems to justify the means, except that we know what the end is and the client doesn't necessarily know what that end is. They think the end is that the dog now is going to be safe from snake bites. We in the training community are going to realize, nope, there's a ton of fallout there. It is not as clear cut as you might be believing or you might be led to believe. And so you kind of have to counter educate people about that.
Yeah, wonderful. Great way to end that conversation. I really want to get your input on something we ask all podcast guests, but I just want to acknowledge as well that this has been an awesome journey, but it's been a long journey. So let's keep this last bit short and succinct. No, it's great. There's quality information in there, and it's worth spending the time to unpack that for the audience of this podcast. So I really appreciate that. But one thing we like to ask all guests is, we've talked about where you started with your master's in United States history. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yes, and then Safari Park and playing with guests and rhinos and giraffes, and then up to where you are today. But can you take us into the future now for you? And maybe we'll stay on snake aversion training, or if you have another message you'd like to share with the audience of the show, please feel free. What do you want to see happen in the next 5-10 years with everything you're doing?
Yeah. So I would just go with two things. One is just in general, of course, a cessation of using snakes with this type of training, and also in using shock on dogs, right? Like, that's just across the board. So I don't know the reality of that happening in 10 years, but that would be my druthers. The second, again, I don't know that how many people would necessarily agree with me, but I would love to see a greater understanding and an appreciation for really how our pet dogs, our animals, pet animals fit into the wider world, particularly in the case of wildlife and conservation, right? So in reality, again, maybe I'm not going to be saying something that's super popular, but dogs are introduced species. And so those of us that have worked in zoos or conservation, we realize the significance of that. A dog is an introduced species. They can agitate and harm wildlife that they can encounter while off leash. So this is, again, while I'm a big proponent of having your dog on leash. So they can, the things that they might do, they're flushing birds. They might be trampling bird nests on the ground. They could be preying on a fledgling or lizards or eggs or rabbits or whatever else might be around, an endangered species that you didn't know about and you weren't aware of. So for me, in my view, again, possibly not popular, is that a dog's happiness does not take priority over the destruction of habitat. So it's not more important for me for my dog to be happy, whatever I might think that might be, if I know that I'm participating in destroying the habitat that's around, the natural wildlife habitat. Again, realizing my dog is an introduced species and a domesticated species that is there to be my friend, but not necessarily a bird's friend. So that's kind of it really for me, is just trying to find some balance there. Not even a balance, like I just a greater understanding of how a dog or even other pet animals fit into the wider world of the environment around us and conservation.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And for sharing.
You're welcome.
for sharing your input. Hey, all of us has been so much fun today, Lynn, and really want to just express again, as I said I would, our gratitude for you, to you, for sharing your offerings with us and for taking the time to sit down with me today and connect before and figure out why our headsets weren't working and connect a few weeks ago and discuss these 10 steps and make sure we package this information up as best we could. And for all the emails beforehand, for all the emails that are going to follow after, thank you for all of the things that have led to this podcast being produced. We appreciate that so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity. It's been a ton of fun.
Likewise. And all of you listening out there, we appreciate you as well. If you have enjoyed this episode and you are interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice, safe ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There is something there for absolutely everyone. We are looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and you'll hear from us again soon.